patience. The sixth talk in a series on the fruit of the Spirit was presented by Ron Julian on July 23, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
And Paul's argument back is that legalism, although it does have an effect on people's behavior, it's actually a fake kind of moral transformation. It doesn't really do anything about the fundamental person. And part of the way you can tell that is that it tends to lead to judgmentalism and self-righteousness and the breakdown of relationships as people self-righteously and selfishly look at themselves as being better than others who are not keeping the rules in the same way and so on. That the true moral transformation is that which comes about through the Spirit of God. It has a certain quality to it. It has certain features to it. And it is those who have been forgiven through the blood of Christ, have been accepted in spite of the fact that they're not what they ought to be. These are the ones who have this moral transformation. So it is not the legalist who arrives at the life that is what life ought to be, but it is the one who is forgiven, the one who has not been what he ought to be and yet is accepted by God, who in the end has this spiritual transformation. And as a part of this argument, Paul lists what he calls the fruit of the Spirit. Today we're talking about the quality that my translation has rendered as patience. So let's talk about the word first of all. What are we getting at here? What does patience mean? If you get the idea that, with the way we use the word patient, I would think of somebody as being patient if they could sit in a waiting room for a long time without fidgeting or something like that. That is a kind of patience, but that's not really what we're talking about here. That's not what this word is getting at. Now, what I'm about to do, you have to be really careful about doing. I'm kind of breaking a rule here, and you want to, don't do this at home. I'm a paid professional. I want to talk about the etymology of this word. That is, where does this word come from? See, the danger is, I've heard teaching all my life where Bible teachers get up and say, this word breaks down to, it means, something, something, something. And what if we stop and think about it, you realize that actually the words that we use don't actually depend so much on where they started. They depend for their meaning on how we use them. And if I talk about understanding someone, I can stop and think about that. That probably comes from the word to stand and the word under. And I could probably come up with this explanation for how that relates to the idea of understanding. But in the end, it's really irrelevant because nobody thinks about standing under somebody when you understand them. We just have the word and we use it the way we use it. And the fact the way it has been used has changed over time. And the question is, how's it used now? Still, every now and again, I think it can at least be helpful as a starting place to recognize where a word comes from and thus where at least it started. This word, patience, is made up of two words in Greek, basically one meaning long or big and the other meaning anger. And so originally this word, where it starts, is something like long to anger. Not long as in desire, but someone who is slow to anger, someone whose anger is long in coming. In the New Testament, this word comes to be used as it describes a quality that we should have or have as believers in two kinds of ways. It can be used in describing my attitude toward the faults of others, and so more literally like the original meaning, slow to anger, slow to respond, slow to strike back, that kind of thing. And it's also used in talking about the attitude that we have toward the difficulties in our own life. Persevering, slow to give up, slow to throw in the towel and say, I'm done, but rather to persevere, to hang in there. These are the two kinds of settings in which the word is typically used in the New Testament. Now, if we lived several generations ago, it would be easy to translate this word, because probably the best, clearest English translation of the word that we're using here is long-suffering. The problem is we don't use that word much anymore, and we probably don't quite understand it anymore the way it was originally intended. To suffer used to be used in a way not to endure agony, but just more simply to endure, to put up with. Maybe you've heard people use an expression like, I don't suffer fools gladly, or something like that. That doesn't mean I don't agonize and have great pain and suffering of fools. I'm saying I don't put up with fools easily. If you're a fool, I draw the line. I don't want to be in your presence. So suffer meant that kind of thing. So to be long-suffering meant to be a person who endured long, to put up with for a long time. And that's really what we're talking about here, to put up with for a long time, either to put up with the difficulties in my life or to put up with the faults and failures of other people over a long period of time. That's what this word is getting at. Now, part of what I'm trying to get across in this whole series is what seems to me to be a very, very important idea for us to understand as believers. We as believers are not just called to a new ethical standard. The Christianity is not just a set of descriptions about how good people ought to behave. And so here, when we talk about being long-suffering, being patient, it's not just that the Bible is saying to me, I want you to put up with things. The virtues that are described in the Bible always come back to and are rooted in a basic perspective on life, a set of beliefs, a way of looking at the world. What the Bible is exhorting me to do is to look at the world the way the Bible is presenting the world, to remember who God is, to remember who I am, to remember what God has promised, and thus then to live out of that set of beliefs. What the Bible is exhorting me to do, in other words, is to believe the gospel and live in accordance with it. It's not just saying, be the sort of person who patiently, you know, if somebody's bugging you, you just sit there and do nothing. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for doing nothing. And some of the reasons that we might do nothing in response to difficult things aren't particularly good ones. I mean, you have a neighbor who's a pest, and every day this neighbor comes over, uninvited, comes into your house, sits down, and sits there for 3 hours and bores you to death with stories about people that you don't know, never talks to you about your life, never asks you how you're doing, just barges in, eats all your food, takes up all your time, and leaves. Okay, so now you respond to this by being long-suffering. That is, every day you let him in and you don't say anything. Well, big deal. I mean, maybe that says something really significant about you, or maybe it just says that your mom brought you up to be hospitable and to be really embarrassed at you know, I never want to confront anybody. I never want to say anything to cause any trouble. So I just sit there, quote, patiently and take it. But inside, I'm seething. It's building up. Every day the person comes, I'm more and more irritated with this person. And sooner or later, if something doesn't happen, they're going to come to the door and I'm going to leap upon them and strangle them to death. Well, the fact that you waited a long time to do that doesn't really qualify as long-suffering in the way the Bible is talking about. The biblical virtue of long-suffering is, it is patient endurance for a reason. It is patient endurance because I have a long view. I have taken the long view on my life. We endure, we press on, because we believe that there is an outcome which brings resolution to our present difficulties. Stuffing my reaction to difficult situations is not long suffering. If I have no wisdom, I have no perspective on the things that I'm enduring, then I'm not really long suffering in the way the Bible is talking about. So let me see if I can show you what I mean. These are not hard ideas to understand, I don't think. We've already talked about some of this. There's a certain overlap in the ideas in the fruits of the Spirit, and the peace that we talked about last week is certainly related to the long suffering of this time. But let me see if I can show you what I see the Bible presenting as the picture of long suffering, what it's rooted in and why we do it. First of all, this word is used to describe our attitude toward the difficulties of our life in the light of our faith. This word is very close in meaning, the way it's used here, with the idea of perseverance. I hang in there. I have heard the promises of God, and in spite of the pressures on my life, I hold to those promises. I endure through the difficulties. Those difficulties do not push me away. Jesus tells the parable about the sower who sows the seed on different kinds of soil. And when he pictures the seed that lands on the shallow soil, that grows up immediately, but then the sun bakes down on it and kills it, that was a response to the gospel that was not long-suffering. It did not endure. When the opposition came, when persecution came, or whatever difficulty it might be, its response was to dry up and disappear. It wasn't deep-rooted. There wasn't anything substantial to it. To be long-suffering is to not be like that, but to have something real and substantial in our faith that stands up, patiently waits until the fulfillment of the promise. For instance, in Hebrews, Abraham is given as a model for us, as one who had great promises and who was patient, who was long-suffering in waiting for those promises to come. He was promised a descendant who would found a great nation, but he had to wait till he was an old man before he actually saw the fulfillment of that. He was promised a homeland, but he himself never lived as a native of that land, but wandered through it as a stranger and an alien. He was promised a blessing that would come to him and to the whole world. But ultimately, the blessing that he was looking for, that he was promised, never really came to him in his lifetime. In Hebrews, he is described as having patiently waited and then having obtained the promise. And then we are encouraged to be like him. We should be imitators of those like Abraham, who through faith and patience, through faith and long-suffering, inherit the promises. So the picture is, the exhortation is, look, there is a promise there. There is an inheritance waiting. I know that that promise is real. I believe, as Abraham believed, that God is there and that he keeps the promises that he has made. And so I patiently wait. I expect that God is going to do what he has said he will do. Meanwhile, in the midst of the difficulties of my life now, I wait. I endure. I hold on. But why am I doing it? I'm doing it because I believe there is a resolution to this. There is a great deal of difference between sort of being numb and just sort of waiting and waiting. No hope, no expectation, nothing but the idea that somehow I can't think of what else to do, so I guess I'll just put up with this until I die. Long-suffering in the biblical sense is to have that view ahead that says, I am on a journey. There is meaning to what I am going through now, and it is taking me someplace that I want to go. One of my favorite passages in the Bible, I mean, if you want to understand something about how I think about my life as a believer, so the picture that really, I can't tell you, this passage has had a profound impact on me. There's a simple little passage in the book of James, chapter 5. Be patient, therefore, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. Behold, the farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too be patient, strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. As an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we count those blessed who persevered. You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. Okay, now James is writing to people who are facing great difficulty. They're going through various trials. This is the book that starts out, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. And he says that because he is talking to people who indeed are encountering various trials. They're suffering in many ways, and they're facing hard decisions about what do they really believe about life. And many of them are making foolish decisions. Many of them are behaving as if they're not really believers at all, as if this world is all there is, and what they can grab in this world is all that they can get a hold of. Their faith is being tested. And he exhorts them to persevere, to hold fast to the faith until the end. That is, in the midst of life, in the midst of these difficulties, in the midst of these places where they have to make a choice, is the gospel real? Is God really there? Can I count on this? Am I a fool to be investing my life in these promises? Or is this indeed where life is to be found? In the middle of those issues, where the implications of their faith are starting to come home to them, he's saying, don't walk away. Hold on to the faith. Let it tell you what it has to tell you about life. Hold fast to those promises. The Lord is coming, he says. I mean, his exhortation to persevere is firmly rooted in this expectation for the future. Jesus is coming back to establish his kingdom and bring his inheritance to his people. And they should hold on until he does. And then the picture that has always meant so much to me, the old-timers around here, this is, you know, number 37 or something for the times I've mentioned this passage probably. He talks about us as being like farmers who are waiting patiently for the produce of the soil. To me, it's a great and helpful analogy. It just helps me to get a picture of how James sees this. The farmer goes out into the field and he's working hard. He's putting seed in the ground, he's watering it, he's taking out the weeds. There's all kinds of stuff to be done. And you're in the middle of that process. It is hard work, but it is not meaningless work. It is work that you're doing because, as he says, he's looking for the precious produce of the soil. The farmer is literally saving his life and the lives of the people who depend on him in a physical sense. The food that we need to eat is growing up from the ground. That's why I'm doing all this work. There is a result at the end. Well, that's the exhortation that James makes to them. think about your life as if you were a farmer. You're sowing so that you can reap in the end. A very biblical idea. I mean, how many times do we see that kind of language in the Bible? That you face the question now, how are you going to sow so that in the end you can reap? You can reap the harvest. What James is describing here, be patient, therefore, brethren, be long-suffering until the coming of the Lord. The farmer is long-suffering as he goes through all that he has to do. He waits for the early rains and then the late rains, and still the harvest is not here, but he expects it. That's what all his work is about. That's what long-suffering, from the biblical perspective, is all about. It is hanging in there with a purpose and a hope and an expectation. I'm going through what I'm going through now, and I am not giving up because I know where I'm headed. As James says, we can be patient because we have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings. The outcome. That's the emphasis. Think about how God has dealt with someone like Job in the past. Job had great difficulties, but in the end, God was faithful and restored him. Think about how he dealt with the prophets. Most of his prophets suffered as his messengers, and many of them died at the hands of the people that they were sent to serve. And yet their reward is great. Jesus says the same thing. Wouldn't you like your reward to be like the reward of the prophets? Well, that's the choice we face. Shall I be faithful to God now? Be long-suffering in this life so that I can reap the outcome that God has for his people? Long-suffering and outcome are very much tied together. So I hope what I'm saying here is clear. We're not just talking about just sort of mindlessly gutting it out. We're talking about hopefully enduring. I endure because I know what this is about. I know the end of this story. And it is interesting that this kind of perseverance is specifically described in other places as a work of God, a work of God's Spirit in our hearts. In Colossians 1:11, Paul talks about, he prays that they might be strengthened with all power according to his glorious might for the attaining of all perseverance and patience. All perseverance and long-suffering. This is his prayer and expectation. The glorious might of God. Think about God. This is the power that created the entire universe, the power that cannot be thwarted. The glorious power of God. He's saying, this is, if you think about God, how big he is, how much he can do, it's mind-boggling. It's glorious. It brings glory to God to think about how big this power is. That huge power is the power that is being brought to bear in my life to make me patient, to make me long-suffering, to hold me fast and keep me holding fast to the promises of the gospel. Okay, so one of the ways that the word patient or long-suffering is used is to describe this attitude arising out of our faith towards our own difficulties in life and the perseverance, the endurance to hold on until the promised fulfillment. That's one of the ways this word is used. The other way that it is used is to talk about us being patient and long-suffering toward each other. To forbear, to put up with. And we started to talk about this idea last week when I talked about we're being called to peace, and I think primarily the peace that Paul had in mind was to be at peace with each other. It is interesting. I just quoted that passage from James about the farmer and so on. I left out one verse. Right in the middle of it, he says, "Do not complain, brethren, against one another, that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door." In the middle of his exhortation to be like this patient farmer, reminding us that the Lord is coming as Savior and to bring our inheritance, he reminds us that we need to have a certain attitude toward each other and reminds us that God is coming as judge as well. We are called to be patient, to be long-suffering with each other, with each other's faults. Find it in a number of places. Here's a pretty clear one, I think, in 1 Thessalonians 5:14. "And we urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with all men. See that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all men." So, being patient with all men here is, not only am I to endure the difficulties of my life in expectation of the fulfillment which God has promised, but I am to endure you as well, and you are to endure me. I think, again, that this sort of endurance, our putting up with each other, is not just a, I'm going to grit my teeth and pretend you're not there sort of endurance. Again, it is rooted in my perspective on what is true, my hopes, my beliefs about the future, my beliefs about myself. It may seem strange to say that my beliefs about the future affect how I think about and treat you now, but I really do think that's the biblical perspective. The future holds, in the end, a day when God is going to judge the world and bring about his kingdom. And on that day, there will be mercy and there will be justice. And both of those things ought to mean something to me now as I'm living my life. Now, I know there is a hurdle, and I don't know that I'm all that great in getting over it, but what I'm saying can sound, I'm sure, very abstract. You really think that the abstract notions like mercy and justice are supposed to make a difference to the obnoxious people that I'm dealing with all around me? And my answer is yes. Yes, I believe that's supposed to make a difference. I know what we're talking about here. I mean, I know the difficulties that we face, the kind of situations we're facing in life. People take unfair advantage of us. People say evil things about us. People misjudge us and accuse us of things that aren't true. People take advantage of us. People take our real faults and mistakes and use them against us. They talk about us with other people. They gossip about us. People get angry. They overreact to our very real faults. And they lash out at us. People that ought to care about us don't. People that ought to be on our side are indifferent to us. People that we have tried to treat well turn around and take advantage of us. The people that are closest to us sometimes take us the most for granted. There's a lot. I mean, just stop, you know. We'll have a moment of silence and everybody stop and think about, you know, the top five people that are the most difficult for you to deal with. I cannot believe that you can't find five. I'll bet every one of you can find five to put in that list. How can I be long-suffering in the face of things like that? Why would the Bible call me to do such a thing? Why does God care? I mean, it talks about God's wrath. Can't I have some wrath? Can I just tell these people to get lost? I mean, that makes sense. There's a certain sense that makes. Go away. You're bad. It all comes down to what it is I believe about the world. I believe that God exists and that one day he is going to judge the world. He is going to execute justice and he is going to grant mercy. And both of these truths are profoundly important. My long suffering with the faults of the people around me is not just ignoring their faults and stuffing my reaction. There is plenty of room for a very real recognition that something is wrong. But I believe in a world ultimately where wrong things are going to be made right. This is all heading somewhere. Either God is going to show mercy to these people, and he's going to do it on the very costly basis of the blood of Christ, or he is going to execute justice. And both of those are good things. Justice is an appropriate consummation to a world like this. And mercy is a wonderful and compelling consummation to a world like this. Mercy is great, and justice is good. What keeps this from being abstract is if I have started to wrestle with the question of where do I stand in the midst of all this stuff. You guys are not the only sinners in the world. I'm one too. My future holds, in the end, either mercy or justice. And that ought to really mean something to me. Now, to a lot of people in the world, it doesn't mean a thing. And why is that? Because they don't really believe in the God that the Bible has revealed. They don't really believe in a God of justice. And they don't believe in a God of real mercy. They believe in a benevolent God, many of them. God's going to be nice to everybody. But they don't really believe in a God who takes justice so seriously that he became a man and died on a cross so that he might be merciful to some. But if I've come to terms with that, then I have to come to terms with where am I in the midst of all of that. My future holds one of those two things. And if it's mercy, and I understand what that means, then I know I am a person who would be in big trouble, and yet God has reached out to me. He is not holding against me what he very well could hold against me. And the reason he can do that is that Jesus died as an offering for my sins. If that's hitting home to me, that's my story. I really am guilty. I really am in trouble, and I was rescued. Then my picture of the future has an impact not only on the way I think of my life, but the way I think of you as well. Your future holds the same thing. God is going to take care of the problem of all of the sin in the world, and he's going to do it either through judgment or through mercy. He is the one who's going to solve that problem. So let me be clear. What are we being called upon to do and why? Rather than striking back at those who have sinned against us, we are being told to endure, to be long-suffering, to be patient with their faults. Why are we doing this? Because we know the truth. We know that God is being long-suffering with us, and that we, in turn, are going to be long-suffering with each other. And in the end, either his mercy or his justice is going to prevail, and that is going to be the solution to the problem. So although I know the concepts are abstract, mercy and justice and so on, it really comes down to, I mean, if I have gotten a hold of it personally, it comes down to a very personal, emotional level. I mean, just think about those times. I'm sure you had some time in your life when you were caught, when you were nailed, your parents had you dead to rights or something. I mean, some spot where you had brought misery upon yourself, and the response that person had to you was to be merciful. How great a thing that is. Well, that's what God is doing with us. We can ignore it if we insist on the picture of basically, I'm okay, and there's nothing really wrong with me, and this world is pretty much what I'm looking for as payoff. Okay, well then this idea about God's mercy doesn't really mean a whole lot. But the more I have come to understand how desperate my situation is, the more I understand how great a thing God is doing in being merciful to me. I am patiently waiting for the fulfillment of God's promises to me. And that in turn can become a basis for me to patiently endure the problems that you have. I'm going to be all right because God is being merciful to me. I can afford to be merciful to you. And in the end, God will decide. He will show you mercy as I pray He will show me mercy, or He will mete out justice. And either way, God, the one who knows what He's doing and who has perfectly put His creation together, will have solved the problem. That's the picture out of which our long suffering with each other comes. Okay, so once again, then, here's what this point that I'm trying to get across. This fruit of the Spirit that Paul is describing is not just this supernatural feeling that comes upon me. It's not just I go around being patient. Gosh, you know, I used to be so irritable, and now I'm just patient all the time. It's not like that. That's not the biblical picture. The fruit of the Spirit is that which results from a new perspective, and that new perspective results from our faith becoming strong and real. I mean, if I'm wrong about this, I'm wrong about most everything I tell you, because this is foundational to my understanding of what the Bible is calling us to. That basically, at the bottom level of all of this, are the fundamental basic promises of the gospel. God exists. He is showing you mercy, which you desperately need. And in the end, He is going to bring your life to fulfillment in His kingdom. That's the story. And we could fill it out. There's a lot more to that story, but it's pretty basic. In coming to believe that, then, I build upon that foundation a life. If that's truly the foundation I'm building on, then my life is going to look a certain way. But it starts with that set of beliefs about the world, about who God is and what He's doing. So this is why I say so often that essentially the exhortations in the Bible are, in essence, an exhortation to believe the gospel. If we're exhorted to be patient with each other, that's another way of saying believe the gospel. If we're exhorted to persevere in our faith, that's another way of saying believe the gospel. If we're exhorted to forgive each other, that's another way of saying believe the gospel. Because it's not just the outward action that it's exhorting us to, it is exhorting us to believe the gospel and thus live our lives in a certain way. So here, when we talk about being long-suffering, how we respond depends on ultimately what we believe to be true. What's so important in this is if the hope of the gospel is not capturing our hearts, then at best we can only fake patience. There is a kind of patience out there. There's even a kind of patience, I think, that defends itself in the name of Christianity. We're told we're supposed to be patient, and so we're patient. But it's just that plastered-on smile. I go to church. I know that everybody there is supposed to be smiling at everybody, and so I smile back. But the problem is, inside, I'm unreconciled to all of this. This is not the way I want it to be. Inside, I am still resentful. I'm still caught up in another way of thinking about the world. I think about the world the way everybody else thinks about the world, and I plaster on the top of it this smile that says I'm being long-suffering with everybody. I think many of us have experienced that in church settings and are impatient with it. In the end, you know that it doesn't really get you anywhere because there's all this hostility brewing below the surface, and it comes out. And it's not real long-suffering. It's just this religious posture that we're all taking, and we help each other take it because everybody expects that you're going to act that way, and you're just going to be quietly pushed to the side if you don't act the way everybody else is acting. That's not long-suffering from the biblical perspective. The question is, have I come to understand what life is really about? I can plaster on a smile and play the brave Christian, or I can have the perspective of the farmer. I'm working for a reason. My eye is on the harvest. See, as I mentioned sometimes, there is that expression that Christians kick around about, we'll say about somebody, he's so heavenly minded, he's no earthly good. And while there is a kind of reality to that, that can happen. It doesn't have to happen. And in fact, the biblical teaching is that in one sense, you can't really be any earthly good until you're more heavenly minded. It is having that perspective that my hope is fixed, as Peter says, completely on the grace to be revealed to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. It is when my hope is fixed on the right thing that it that washes back and gives me perspective on where I am now. The farmer is very future-oriented in one sense. Every single thing that he's doing is he's doing because of the harvest. If there were no harvest, he wouldn't go out and do it. I mean, think about it. If there were no harvest, is there any farmer in the world that would just go out, dig up the ground, put seeds in, water it, go through all of that stuff, and at the end of the season say, well, that was fun? No. You do it for a reason. And yet, at the same time, if you think about that analogy of the farmer, who is more practical and down to earth? I mean, I'm entirely focused on, in another sense, the task before me. Because I'm looking for the harvest and my hopes are fixed entirely on what is to come, I had better turn my attention to what is before me. I better get the seeds in the ground. I better get them watered. I have a job to do. But I'm doing it out of this perspective. So, the perspective that the gospel is true does not, it can't, at least it should not, turn my attention to the future in such a way that I ignore the responsibilities that I have in this world. It sheds light on the responsibilities that I have in this world. It gives priorities for me as I pursue the responsibilities in this world. It shows me which responsibilities are truly profoundly important and which ones can be set aside. It gives me a hierarchy of values. It shows me what my life is about. Now, if we're being long-suffering, if we're holding on out of an understanding that that is what God is doing, that that's where my life is headed, that is long-suffering from the biblical perspective. And the same thing is true with the attitude that we have toward each other. We can put on the fake smile and just sort of grit our teeth and put up with each other. Or we can take the harder and longer road of coming to terms with who we are and how God is being merciful to us, and thus confront those issues as we're dealing with each other. And so what we see is the picture of the fruit of the Spirit here again is the Spirit of God at work in me, enlightening me in the midst of my life, over the years of my life, through the struggles of my life, strengthening, bringing home to me the reality of the gospel, the importance of the gospel, the personal importance of the gospel. And as it comes home to me then, these qualities start to emerge, not as tacked on, fake, plastered on attitudes that I take so that I fit in the church, but as a natural result of the fact that my eyes are fixed on the horizon instead of right down at my feet. I'm getting perspective. I'm taking in the whole scene by the work of the Spirit of God. But what it also means, because the Spirit is at work through the very choices I make in my life, that I can't escape the fact that I must choose. Yes, ultimately I believe it is a work of the Spirit of God, but it doesn't mean that I can just sit back and say, okay, so someday I guess the Spirit will do something. Today, I'm facing the choice. Is the gospel true or not? And if it is, then I'm going to face the implications of that. I'm facing the implications of it as I deal with you, as I deal with myself, as I deal with my problems, as I deal with my desires. When you put all of that together, all of that, either I am wrestling with those things in the light of the gospel or I'm not. That's what's at stake here. The legalists that Paul is speaking against have basically dodged the bigger issues. They have come along and said, hey, keep these rules and God will like you and everything will be okay. I keep the rules, so that must mean I'm okay. What's wrong with you? And so we have self-centeredness, self-importance, a faulty view of myself, a faulty view of God, and it leads to, ultimately, the fruit of the flesh. It just isn't going to get you anywhere. It is when I understand, no, I'm not standing before God because I've kept the rules. He is being merciful to me. If he were not being merciful, I would be lost. And his mercy is leading me into life. Now, that becomes the foundation upon which to build a real set of relationships, a long suffering which is built on something real, which can last, which can make it through the storms. And that's ultimately what's at stake. Okay, well, we have a little time for any questions or comments you might have. As happens to me sometimes, I'm getting dizzy, so I think I'm going to sit down while you talk.
I have a question, Ron. You said that part of what we're doing is we look out over the landscape and we see what God is doing, and that becomes a basis for action for what we do. We walk according to the gospel. Can you tell me, what does Paul mean by walk by faith and not by sight?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. What I've just described, we understand this instinctively on a human level. We understand how my beliefs about the future can profoundly impact how I live now. In our situation, Robbie and I live in a nice house that is probably by many standards, including our own, just a tiny bit small for the number of people who are in it. Okay, so we have, to a certain extent, to turn our attention to things like we either have to throw this stuff away or figure out some place to put it. You know, storage is a big thing. You know, where are we going to put this stuff? If I say, hey, I think it would be great and our lives would be greatly enhanced if we were to buy one of these, everybody's first reaction is, yeah, but where would we put it? Okay, so, you know, we have this one hole that wanders around the house where you can put one thing. If you want to put two things down, you're out of luck. You put something down in the one hole and move the hole someplace else. That's how it works. Okay, so somebody comes along and says, you know, in a certain amount of time, I have this huge multi-room house, a bathroom for every member of the family. You know, everybody has their own room, lots of storage and all of that kind of stuff. And it's coming. We all instinctively understand that the way I conduct myself now in my little house is going to change. All of a sudden, I'm not so concerned about storage issues because I know that all of my storage issues are going to be taken care of. I mean, this is a silly, mundane sort of example, but you understand, in this life, you tell me that things are going to change, and I'm confident that they're going to change. Hey, I can get with the program easily. You know, I have this terrible job, but I know I'm getting a new one. All of a sudden, I have this attitude towards the terrible job that I've got that I can put up with this. Because it's not this endless, hopeless sort of thing. It's just, oh, okay, I've got something great ahead of me. The thing about it is, in this life, I can see all of those things are tangible. I've talked to the next guy who's going to hire me. I've seen the house that I'm going to be moving into. I mean, you know, it's all real and tangible, and it's easy for me to get a hold of it and say, I know why things are going to be okay for me. If you tell me I've got $1 million coming to me, and so all my financial struggles are going to be over, I know what money is. I've seen it. I've seen what it can do. It's all very tangible and real. I know what's going on with that. But when it comes to the most important issues of my life, I am basically dealing with things that are unseen. I'm trusting in God, and I have never seen Him. I'm counting on Christ's death on the cross on my behalf. I didn't see Him die. I didn't see Him rise from the dead. I haven't seen Him at all. I don't know what He looks like. I don't know what His voice sounds like. You know how you can tell a lot about people by their body language? I'm always hoping that you are all not reading my body language as I'm talking, because I know I'm strange. But the fact is, I have this terrible experience. Every now and again, the Gutenberg students, one of them will do an imitation of me, and I can't come out again for a week afterwards. These tangible things that we count on in this world, we don't have when it comes to God. He's promised me a kingdom. I don't know what that kingdom looks like. All of this is based on the story that I have been told about what God did in the past. My belief that this story is true. Now, do I have good reasons to believe this story is true? I think so. Is our faith insubstantial and hardly holding together? No. I think it's a chain. It is strong. It holds together. But still, it's pointing to things I can't see. So when he talks about walking by faith and not by sight, I think what he means is I'm conducting myself, making these choices day by day based on the reality of certain things. Just like I lift my foot to step over a ditch. Well, if you tell me, I know you can't see it, but there's a ditch there. And I say, okay, well, I guess I'll step over it. I'm walking by faith and not by sight. I don't see the ditch, but I believe you, so I'll lift my foot and try to avoid it anyway. I think that's what I'm saying, is that these fruit of the Spirit, in a sense, are a result of walking by faith and not by sight. I am living as if certain things are true, because they are true. Most of them are things that I can't see. So I can't tell you they're true, because, you know, I can go and grab Jesus by the collar and pull him out and say, see, here he is. I can't do that for you. And so in that sense, I can't even do that for myself. I don't see the things that I am walking by. You know, I'm flying on instruments. But nonetheless, I have confidence in those instruments. I'm making my choices based on what I have been told by my instruments. Mostly this. It tells me what the terrain is like, and I'm making my decisions based on it. So I think that's what it's getting at.
I just want you to know that you have made a superb presentation this morning, and we don't, I think, recognize the gift that you are to all of us, and thank you.
Oh, thanks.
I I also commend your presentation along with that other brother. I'm having trouble connecting two dots here, and I think it's a pre-caffeine state of mind. I agree entirely with your presentation of what patience in and of itself looks like. I've been struggling for years trying to balance out that as a rooted foundation because of who has called us and what we've been called to, and dealing with someone else in the body of Christ who has offended us, specifically in regards to the section in Matthew 18, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone, and then the discipline,
right.
You know.
Right.
And there are several other sections, too, that point to that. And I really would like to be able to connect the dots somehow between
right.
being long-suffering and yet doing that as well.
Right, right. Well, I don't know how well I can connect them for you. It's something I've thought about a lot. I can tell you how far I am in thinking about it right now. It seems to me that part of this picture is the idea, this comes back to another part of it. We talked about it a couple weeks back, but I didn't emphasize it so much today. One of the fundamental truths that we're operating out of, we've been called to love God with all our heart, soul, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourself. In other words, that I am being called to think about, to put the welfare of other people on a par with my own, is what I understand that to be saying. I think the biblical admonitions, both to be forbearing and at times to be forthright and to speak to the sins, especially of those who are believers around me, both of them, I think, are rooted in the idea that I am seeking the welfare of the other person. For me not to be long-suffering is to have that sense that I need to satisfy myself and strike back. I need to somehow, I want to send you away, I want to tell you off, I want the satisfaction of giving you what I think you've got coming in some sense. And that's what I can't do. But if I'm thinking about what is for your benefit, then there is definitely a place for being discerning, for recognizing the serious situations into which people can get themselves, and to try to be redemptive. I mean, the passage that I think of in connection with the Matthew 18 one is at the end of Galatians, right after the section that we're looking at here, where Paul talks about, see, he's urging them. He's in the middle of talking to these legalists who are all too prepared to say, oh, you're not keeping the rules right, and so on. And the dissension and the judgmentalism that arises from that. He says, in response to that, brethren, even if a man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted. Bear one another's burden and thus fulfill the law of Christ. And what he's basically doing in that section, I think, is going on to say, yes, we are. There are those places where people are caught in a trespass. Something is going on. Maybe, I mean, if someone in our midst is having an adulterous affair or something like that, it is not wise, and it is not loving to just say, well, I'm supposed to be long-suffering, so I'll just say, okay, that's okay. Well, I'll just accept you the way you are. The fact is that there's still a redemptive purpose in speaking out to them and saying there's something wrong here. But where am I coming from? The judgmental person has downplayed his own faults and responsibilities before God and is playing up, as a judge, the faults of someone else. What Paul's advocating here is the opposite. If I'm going to be concerned about the faults of someone. I ought to be concerned about my faults, bear my own burden in that sense. I'm going to stand before God on my own merits. God does not grade on the curve. It's not like, well, you're so bad, it makes me look good. No, actually it doesn't. I'm going to stand alone. But on the other hand, I am called to bear your burden. Sin is a burden in your life. It is killing you. And there's a sense in which, not out of judgment, not out of condemnation, but out of a desire to be redemptive, I'm going to reach out to you. And also, redemptive in your life and redemptive in the life of the church. Our call in going to the person who's having that trouble, it seems to me the two pictures are, number one, I am seeking to restore them, and number two, if they insist on, you know, hey, you know, I'm a member of this church, but I don't buy, you know, this, you know, faithfulness and marriage stuff or any of that. I mean, you know, I'm gonna do what I want. There comes a point at which the message needs to be sent. You can't thumb your nose at God and claim to be a follower of God at the same time. It's important for everybody else to understand that this is not a big tent in that sense. So, I am not the one who condemns. I am not the one who judges in the sense that somehow I am better off. I know all too well that if God is not merciful, I'm lost. But you need to know the reality of where you are, and the people around need to know the reality of where you are. And that can be done. I mean, the admonition ultimately is that we would do that in humility, that we would humbly point out the reality of what's going on in someone else's life. I think both of those things, you're right, they are difficult to connect, but it's crucial that we try to make the attempt, I think, because too often we as Christians try to throw one or the other away. Since they are difficult to bring together, either we end up throwing away the discernment and the call to hold each other accountable, and we just say, hey, whatever goes, or else we get very concerned about, you know, pointing out to everybody where they're going wrong, and we lose sight of our call to be patient and long-suffering and to forbear. Both of those things are true. We are supposed to go the distance with each other, and at the same time, we're supposed to tell each other the truth. Okay, well, I think we're out of time. Thanks. We'll look at kindness. Is that the next one? Next week?